This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello and welcome back to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Bill McCush. This week, Dialogue's Cora Perrigo went off the beaten track, filing two reports about a freak show and another about the paranormal. We'll hear from some frustrated banking customers adjusting because their branches are shutting down in New Waterford and Glace Bay. Speaking of Glace Bay, the food bank there has its hands full getting ready for Christmas. Also, two provincial party leaders are on the show, drumming up support for the election on November 26th. These stories are coming up on the Coast. Provincial Liberal leader Zach Churchill says the Cape Breton Regional Municipality will have more autonomy if his party wins the election on November 26th. While campaigning in Sydney, he stopped by the Coast Studios to explain the CBRM will be able to go ahead with projects, usually requiring the province's blessing.
We want to make sure that CBRM has more control over its destiny by creating a charter. The charter will give additional powers to CBRM, so they will be able to have more say over funding.
A charter is basically a document paving the way for a municipality to use provincial funds for construction and infrastructure development without approval from Halifax. A charter will also enable the CBRM to bypass provincial red tape on planning, zoning, and taxation. Churchill says his government will also cut the HST from 15% to 13%. He says this will translate into significant savings for the taxpayers.
We are going to make life more affordable for Nova Scotians. Everybody who votes for us knows that they're going to get $3,000 back in tax reforms. That's real money in people's pockets. That's enough money to pay for that summer, winter vacation, put the kids in hockey. That's a year's worth of telephone and internet bills. That really matters.
Churchill says $3,000 is a lot of money, but it's expensive on the government's end to make it happen. He says it is achievable, though, if they operate in the red until they bounce back before the end of the term.
We have the revenue right now to do this. We have a fully costed platform. We are willing to run deficits in the first 3 years of a four-year mandate to provide this financial relief to people because the government can afford to do this, and people can't afford for us not to. But by the time we get to our fourth year in our mandate, we will be back to a balanced budget. So we do have a long-term financial plan. We will take a short-term hit on the books, but people need it right now. People can't afford to pay the highest taxes in Nova Scotia anymore.
Meanwhile, a new poll by MQO Research out of Halifax puts Liberal Party supporting Cape Breton at 23%, second to the PC's 52%. The survey shows 19% for the NDP. Churchill says there is still time to garner more public support before the votes are counted on Election Day, November 26th. He says the party will stress its promises over the coming days as the campaign trail winds down.
I think if voters are paying attention to the platforms, they will see that ours is the most complete. It tackles the issues that matter. It's going to put more money back in their pocket. It's going to really have a long-term plan to tackle housing and power bills and grocery prices. And it's going to create more health clinics that will get doctors into family practice and more patients attached to family doctors. So I have confidence that we have the best plan. It's my job to sell that and to make sure people know about it. But for any voter that's paying attention, they know that we were the first one to get our platform out, that our campaign is about the ideas that matter and making life more affordable and better here and ensuring that we get back to the basics in healthcare, like getting people family doctors.
Churchill says, aside from the Liberal platform, the Tories are giving unintentional support to the Grits by displaying unethical conduct. PC campaign manager Peter Zwicker resigned after admitting to handing out gift cards at a Tim Hortons drive-thru while the Lunenburg candidate, Susan Corkum-Greek, greeted drivers as they left the coffee shop property.
Well, listen, we have a real pattern of behavior with Mr. Houston's conservatives where they will push every rule and do whatever they think is needed to win. And this is another example of that. But I mean, that like brings us back to the old rum and pantyhose days when all the parties were doing this, right? And it has no place, I think, in today's politics.
Churchill explained some of the terminology there involving clothing and alcohol. He says it's a reference to campaign practices of days gone by.
Well, we've all heard the stories of you know, the old days when the campaign folks for each party would go around and hand out rum to the men and pantyhose to the women. And of course, we've can't come a long way since then, and that's not allowed. You're not allowed to buy votes anymore. You're not allowed to offer people financial incentives to support you. And I think Nova Scotians know that that's not the kind of politics that they want in our province again.
When the campaign manager resigned after handing out the gift cards, Zwicker said the candidate was unaware of what he was doing, and it was only his decision to do so. PC leader Tim Houston says he wants Nova Scotians to have their say on how the province is run, and that's why voters are returning to the polls. Houston says the Tories want to make life more affordable with plans to cut the HST by 1%, as well as what he calls targeted supports through a seniors care grant and the school lunch program. Voters weren't expected to return to the polls until the summer of 2025, but Houston says he called a snap election because priorities have changed since the previous election.
The deal, I guess, that we made with Nova Scotians in 2021 was about healthcare. It wasn't about the things that we need to do now with lower taxes and higher wages. So I feel that Nova Scotians have the right to have their say on how we go forward. And we're putting our plan forward. It's resonating with Nova Scotians. But I do think that they have a right to have their say. That's the first thing. And the second thing is, the relationship with Ottawa is really important to our province, and the Liberals, they've kind of really stuck it to Nova Scotia on a number of things here. Of course, the isthmus is an issue where they're trying to shortchange Nova Scotia by almost $400 million, $500 million. It's significant, and they're trying to shortchange us on that. They've looked the other way on the illegal fishing. That's really important. Like, our fishing industry is incredibly important to our province and the future of our province, and they've just looked the other way on the illegal fishing, and there's a whole series of issues.
Meanwhile, during this campaign, the PC party had to deal with a controversy on the mainland. A PC campaign manager resigned after handing out gift cards near a Tim Hortons drive-thru in Lunenburg. The campaign manager said the candidate, Susan Corkum-Greek, didn't know that he was handing out the free gift cards.
Well, listen, this is a volunteer to a campaign at a time, you know, when people are always talking about engagement, voter turnouts down, all these types of things. It's really nice when you have people step up and volunteer. So this is a volunteer helping out on a campaign who maybe made a mistake, maybe. And if it is a mistake, it amounts to about $52. I think it was 25 gift cards of $2 each or something like this. It was so $52. That's what we'd be talking about in a world where coffee. I don't think you could find any politician right now having a political event that's not giving out coffee, right? Or giving out sandwiches or something like that. So, and we're done with Tim Hortons coffee in Canada. So the fact that the Liberal Party have really tried to vilify this campaign volunteer, and essentially they tried to use the justice system to weaponize the justice system against a campaign volunteer, I think it just tells people how desperate the Liberal Party is. So my understanding is Elections Nova Scotia kind of is they haven't ruled yet. Certainly, I understand they possibly might do it after the campaign, which would tell me that they kind of see it for what it is, too.
Before the election was called, Liberal MLA for Northside Westmount Fred Tilley crossed the floor to the Tory side. Houston was asked, does this demonstrate a proactive approach for an elected official to side with a stronger party for his constituents, or does it leave lingering questions about loyalty?
Fred is a very capable person, like a really, really impressive person, and an excellent constituency MLA was what I was hearing consistently from people in his community. So he's a person who cares. He's the type of person you want in politics. I believe he came to a little bit became a little bit disillusioned with the lack of leadership from the Liberal Party, and it's actually the type of lack of leadership that we see with this Tim Hortons situation here. So I can certainly see what he may have been seeing just from the outside looking in, but I'm just really pleased that he's put his trust in me as a person and his trust in me as a leader and in our party. And I believe that we're going to do some great things together for the people of the area and the people of the province.
A recent poll from MQO Research out of Halifax puts the PC Party in the lead in voter support. Houston's response?
We just work hard. That's all we do. We have great candidates. And I know Johnny and Darren and Brian and Diane and everyone across our entire slate. We just work harder. We know that we have to go and interact with Nova Scotians and talk to them about what they see in this province, the challenges, the opportunities. But it's up to us to earn their trust. And the only thing we know how to do is work hard. This province was built on hard work. As Premier, every day I work harder and harder for Nova Scotians. And we're just a party that rolls up our sleeves and tries to get things done. So that's what we'll continue to do for the rest of the campaign. And if the people of Nova Scotia decide they want us to continue governing them, my commitment is we'll work harder and harder every single day on their behalf for their family.
Coast Radio also requested an interview with the NDP leader, Claudia Chender, but nothing's been scheduled yet. November 26th is Provincial Election Day. Returning offices in the 55 electoral districts and community polls will be open from Monday through Saturday from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. The food bank in Glace Bay has its work cut out for the holidays. Executive Director Linda McCrae says demand increases in December with more families asking for a monthly package of food referred to as a hamper.
We usually do about 400 food hampers close to each month. That will stay probably the same because we have the same clients who come in every month. But we'll have more people in emergency situations who maybe don't use the food bank all the time, but will approach us. And that could be anywhere from maybe 50 to another 100 people. Okay. And that, again, can go up and down. But like I said, they're not here every month, but they just need that extra for the holidays.
The hampers contain a variety of fresh food and non-perishables. McCrae says their clients don't leave empty-handed.
The greatest words I hear is, Linda, this is too heavy to carry. It does our heart good when we hear that, from eggs and bread and canned stuff and sandwich meat and tea bags, coffee. We also give fruits and vegetables from our own garden that we have that was producing for the summer. And there's also people who come in who have their own little farms that bring in different fruits and vegetables. And then they get a freezer bag. And that could be, it's butter, it's hopefully some type of meat, fish, like I said, whatever comes in.
The food bank prepared roughly 325 hampers in December of 2023, but McCrae says demand continued to increase throughout the year. McCrae says traditional clients were part-time workers, low-wage workers, or people on social assistance. However,
the stigma is changing on a food bank because people are beginning to realize that it is hitting the middle class. It is hitting people who are working. So it's all changing now on who needs the food bank. And some of them need it for a while. Some of them need it continuously. Food insecurity is now hitting every walk of life, whether you're working, not working. I mean, people who lose a spouse, it changes their income. They find themselves coming here. Life is really challenging now.
McCrae says their numbers are staggering now, but she wonders how many people actually need help, but they feel too ashamed to visit the food bank. She talks about one woman who struggled to find the courage to ask for help while pacing for a long time on a nearby street, but eventually she went inside to see McCrae.
We're trying to get the message out there. Don't be embarrassed. Don't go hungry. You know, fill your cupboards. Like I had a lady one time, she walked Commercial Street 2 hours trying to get up the courage to come in. She said the hardest thing she did was walk through that door. And we sat down and we talked, and she said, I feel so much better. She said, you've made me feel so comfortable. And she said, it's not an embarrassment anymore. And I think in her case, she absolutely put it off because she didn't want to say, I have to go to a food bank. And all the volunteers I have here, whether they're giving out meals or they're giving out the food hampers, compassion, respect. This food bank is their home, and this is where they should feel comfortable that they can come in for not only food, to talk. Maybe they have to access other services. That's what I'm here for, and that's what the food bank is here for.
McCrae says the kindness of their volunteers extends beyond their food bank walls into the community, with donations coming in locally and abroad.
I can't say enough. What I can say, if it wasn't for the organizations, businesses, community support far and near, like I'm talking across Canada, people that have lived here and are sending money down, they're remembering where they came from. We would not survive without the people in our community. And I can't, words don't express how thankful we are. And I hope they realize and understand how many people that they're helping.
McCrae says because their inventory is stretched out over the holidays, they hope donations will step up to meet the demand of their services. She says she's grateful to even receive one small donation.
What I want people to know, they don't have to come in with cases of stuff. You don't have to come in with bags of stuff. One can. My motto is one can, two can, we all can. And don't feel embarrassed. Like if they bring in a couple of cans, that's a couple of cans we don't have, or a couple of items that we don't have. You're helping everybody, and every little bit helps.
The food bank isn't alone in its struggle to keep up with demand. It's happening all over the country. New data from Food Banks Canada says more than 2 million people are visiting food banks every month, nearly double the monthly visits 5 years ago. The study says rapid inflation, housing costs, and insufficient social supports are driving new levels of poverty and food insecurity. Dialogue's Cora Perrigo recently spoke with Amy McNeil, an investigator and researcher with the PPRI, or the Paranormal Phenomena Investigation Group. McNeil is also the content strategist at Cape Breton University. Here's part two of that conversation, inspired by McNeil's talk, UFOs Have a PR Problem.
It's interesting because you do see those people kind of get into the study of UFOs.
Yes.
Under this kind of sometimes like almost inspired by the pop culture alien thing. And then they're like, actually, I have no idea what this is. And I've completely switched my focus.
Absolutely. It sounds like you're talking about the interdimensional hypothesis. Mm-hmm. And that is something that was popularized by Dr. Jacques Vallée, who believes that non-human intelligence does exist, but doesn't necessarily believe that these are biological beings that come from another planet in a distant solar system or in our own solar system. Dr. Vallée suggested that these were beings that existed alongside us in a higher dimension and that could access our dimension, but we can't necessarily access theirs. And that is one of the predominant theories that I have researched today that makes the most sense to me personally. I do think that it is also possible that there are artificial or biological non-human intelligence that do come from the rest of our known universe. But there is some really compelling evidence and information to suggest that they're not coming from very far at all, that They're not coming at all. They're just here in a similar way to how people might believe that ghosts or spirits exist on a different dimension or plane, but within the same physical space that we exist.
So you said the interdimensional theory is the one that seems the most likely, I suppose, to you?
To me, yeah.
Do you want to expand on why that might be?
One of the reasons is because of the theory of vibration. And so the higher dimension that you live in, the higher your vibration would be. And Dr. John Mack's books had a big influence on me. Dr. John Mack was the head of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. And sometime in the 80s or 90s, he began seeing a subset of patients that colleagues couldn't treat, that colleagues felt had some undiagnosed new type of mental illness. Dr. Mack began seeing these patients, and he determined that they didn't have an undiagnosed mental illness. They did have symptoms and distress around an experience that they had. And he called these people experiencers. And he believed that these people had been subject to alien abduction. He found commonalities across people who otherwise had no commonalities across age, life, lifestyle, race, gender, anything. And one of those commonalities that I read in his book, Abduction, is the sense of the experiencer that when they are visited by a non-human intelligence, that the vibration begins to shift. And they can feel things seemingly speeding up in terms of vibration. And that would be when they actually encounter the non-human intelligence. So I'm not incredibly well-versed on the science behind that, but that's one example of why it rings so true to me, is because when the experiencers have talked about it, it lines up with how we would imagine from a current scientific perspective, shifting between dimensions would work.
Does that have anything to do with that? It's kind of been in the abductee consciousness for a while, but the idea of missing time?
So I'm not sure if it necessarily has a correlation with missing time, but that is a hallmark of an experiencer or of somebody who has experienced alien abduction. Absolutely. Human perception comes into play a lot here, and the manipulation of human perception is sort of widely accepted in this field as being a consequence of having contact with a non-human intelligence.
If someone was looking to start looking into these things for themselves from a more academic perspective, what would you recommend they start with? Like movies, books, like that's still accessible, but still talks about it in a way that isn't just the kind of UFO entertainment that we've seen?
It's a great question. And I would recommend everybody read Leslie Kane's book, UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. But in terms of something that's more accessible, I always recommend The Secret of Skinwalker Ranch. It's a television show that is on the History Channel. I think it is widely dismissed as entertainment, but the people who are involved in the scientific analysis that they show on that television show are highly credible people. The first is Dr. Travis Taylor. Dr. Travis Taylor is one of the main talking heads on that show, and he was the chief, I think he was the chief scientist, or I think he was the chief scientist, but regardless, he was a member of the UAPTF, the Unidentified Anomalous Phenomenon Task Force, that was convened in the United States to seriously study this phenomenon and came up with those 143 unidentified reports. He wasn't allowed to say that for a long time, and he only came out in recent seasons on The Secret of Skinwalker Ranch saying, I was actually a part of this major government group that was investigating this. He's incredibly smart. He's got a number of degrees. He's got masters in optics, physics. I think he has PhDs in aerospace engineering. Here's another one. He is an incredibly smart man. And I don't think that he's actually taken as seriously on that show as he absolutely deserves to be. But he has been involved in, like I say, the serious government study, as well as doing his own study under a new owner of Skinwalker Ranch, because Robert Bigelow sold it 3 or 4 years ago to a new owner. And Travis Taylor has been there since, doing scientific study and publishing that in this television show. It's one of my favorite shows. I watch it all of the time. It's in its fifth season now, I believe. And I suggest people start there, because if you're interested in the stories they tell and the evidence they show, you can go down a rabbit hole from there. So the television show, I would say, is the most accessible. But the next thing I would suggest is the books that are about Skinwalker Ranch and OSAP. And there's three of those. So the first one was written by Colm Kelleher, Dr. Colm Kelleher, who is a biochemist by trade, and he was one of the serious scientists hired by Robert Bigelow to do study on the ranch, and George Knapp, who is a veteran investigative reporter who has been in this field since at least the 80s, and he is a highly credible researcher and reporter who has won 2 Peabody Awards for unrelated work to the field, but she gives you an idea of how credible this person actually is. So in the first book, they were talking about the research that Robert Bigelow had funded on the ranch. That book is called The Hunt for the Skinwalker. Completely recommend. I believe there's audiobooks as well. It's fascinating, but it is technical in its writing. It isn't written like an entertainment novel, nor should it be, though. If it was, I think it would be far easier to dismiss. But it is something that I think that the average person could get through and would find interesting. And the reason I say to start with that book is because that book is the one that so intrigued the defense intelligence community in the States, and they took it very seriously, that Defense Intelligence Agency officer James Lukacsky asked Robert Bigelow, after reading the book, if he could visit the ranch. He did visit the ranch. He had a paranormal experience, and he took that information back to the Pentagon, and that's how he was able to secure the $22 million of funding that became the basis for OSAP. The second book is called Skinwalkers at the Pentagon, and that details the OSAP program itself. Equally fascinating. The things that they talk about in that book are UFOs, non-human intelligence, orbs, cattle mutilations, and other cryptid phenomena like dogmen. Body of a human, head of a dog. This was seen and reported by multiple people across this scientific analysis program. And it is wild. It's absolutely wild. But when you look at the authors of this book, how serious they are, the fact that the book itself, Skinwalkers at the Pentagon, had to be cleared by the Pentagon itself because it was written by a Defense Intelligence Agency officer. It was all about the OSAP program, which was funded by the Pentagon. This book had to be cleared by the Pentagon, and they said, okay. There's a third book that came out, I think it was just late last year, called Initial Revelations, and that is a book by the previous 3 authors, Kelleher, Knapp, and Lukacsky, and it just goes into more detail about the OSAP program as well. And again, it's not written like an entertainment novel, but nor should it be. This is about true scientific analysis that happened on that ranch. And I read an Amazon review of the most recent book, and oh God, I couldn't help but laugh. The review said, it's got some really interesting ideas in it, but it's a pretty dry read because it's written scientifically,
yeah,
right?
Like, shouldn't it be?
Exactly. So I would say start with Leslie Kane's book, watch The Secret of Skinwalker Ranch on the History Channel, and then check out the books that talk about the history of scientific analysis of UFOs and related phenomena on Skinwalker Ranch. And from there, the world would be open. I mean, those pieces of information lead to so many more. But that's where I would start.
2 of the books that I've seen recently that have intrigued me were UFO by Garrett Graff and Luis Elizondo.
Thank you. I'm not familiar with the former. I am familiar with Luis Elizondo. I haven't read his book. I absolutely want to. I believe it's called Imminent.
Yes.
Yep. So Luis Elizondo, this is an interesting guy as well. So he was involved in ATIP, AATIP. So that's the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program. And in that 2017 New York Times article that I talked about, the program, the government study program that received $22 million was misidentified in that article as ATIP. But Luis Elizondo will tell you, as well as anybody else involved, that program, ATIP, did not receive the $22 million in funding. It was OSAP. Mm-hmm. So whether that was a genuine confusion or perhaps a direct misidentification, I don't know. But the program that Luis Elizondo was involved with was much smaller in scale. And I believe it revolved around receiving reports from American military, Air Force, Navy officials on the phenomenon. And he had the job of sort of tracking down and investigating this, verifying it. Luis Elizondo is one of the most important whistleblowers that has come out of the United States, and he does a lot in the field of disclosure. So I haven't read his book yet, and I haven't paid as much attention to ATIP as I have OSAP, just because I find OSAP more interesting. It is fascinating what you can learn and read about what's happened on Skinwalker Ranch. But Luis Elizondo is highly credible.
American Cosmic by D.W. Pasulka, UFOs, yes. Religion, and Technology.
Yes, I actually quote that book in my presentation. So that's Diana Walsh Pasulka. And she's an academic in the United States who's actually a professor of religious studies. So she began to investigate the UFO phenomenon. And it's a book worth reading. You definitely should.
I was definitely very curious about it.
You should. This is another person who came at the field indirectly. So throughout her religious research, she had actually seen UFO motifs coming up. And she theorized that the belief in UFOs, modern day, represented a new religion. And she did her research on the basis of this, hoping to prove that theory. In fact, she felt that theory was disproved because in her research, she found that UFOs represented, much like Leslie Kane did, a real true physical phenomenon and not some kind of new belief or new religion. And she actually followed up her book, American Cosmic, with a second book called Encounters. And this book deals with human encounters with non-human intelligence. So she went down that sort of rabbit hole as well and now has published those two books about both UFOs and non-human intelligence. And her perspective is really interesting because she is a true academic. She is a professor of religious studies, I think, at the University of North Carolina. She's not a scientist. However, because she's gotten into this field, she's become involved with the science of it. So she has actually done work with Dr. Gary Nolan, who I referenced before. She also does interviews, podcasts, and she's talked about the fact that she has been to a UFO crash site with Dr. Nolan, where he retrieved materials to test in his laboratory. And she is also a peer reviewer of scholarly journal articles about the scientific analysis of UFOs. And she has said in the recent past, the last 12 months, that there's a lot more coming out that she's been peer reviewing as a matter of these scholarly journal articles. And she expects that the next few years are going to be exciting for this field.
It really seems like a thing of the more you learn, the less you know.
100%. Absolutely. And that's why I think it frustrates me so much that the public is kept so in the dark and that the phenomenon is still denied so much. Mm. I think there is a way to protect national security and defense interests while also admitting the reality of the phenomenon and also coming clean about what it is they don't know. I think one of the reasons that the governments of the world, speaking more specifically about the American and potentially the Canadian government here, I think the reason that those governments haven't been more forthright is because they don't have the answers.
I've seen that a lot. It's been during my research into my own strange phenomenon. There's the fear that the government knows and isn't telling us, and there's the fear that the government also does not know.
That's right. That's right. And I think they know a whole heck of a lot more than they obviously admit to. But I think just like for them, as well as the rest of the series researchers that I've spoken about, you get more questions than answers. And this is one of the reasons why I think that open and acknowledged scientific analysis is so important, because analysis, again, speaking of the American government, it happens in silos. Researchers, scientists are given a very small piece of the puzzle to try to figure out without knowing how that puzzle fits into the rest. They get puzzle A and they don't know how that fits into puzzle B, C, D, E, or F. And without being able to look at it holistically from the larger, broader perspective, I think that scientific analysis and new information about this phenomenon is going to be really stilted until we can look at it really openly from a big, broad perspective. But because it is still cloaked in secrecy, it is majorly siloed. And actually, Jacques Vallée talks about that as well, how one university will be working on a project and not realize that another university is working on the very same project and the left hand is not talking to the right hand. I find that even at the university I work at, there'll be strategic projects that multiple groups are working on, and we might not know about it until we have a conversation about it over lunch. I think that's one of the reasons we need to be more open about this.
What advice would you give to someone who is looking into these books and these shows and these movies? What mindset would you say for them to go into it with?
It's a really great question. And I think you have to start with acknowledging and addressing your fear. And this has been something that I've been interested in and believed in since I was a small child. When I was literally 4 and 5 years old, used to watch Star Trek: The Next Generation with my dad. And my dad was a really religious man, but And I always admired this about him. He was incredibly religious, but he was also very open scientifically to the universe. And he believed UFOs and aliens were real, as much as he believed that God was real. Because he believed, and because we watched these shows together, I believed. And we had these conversations together. And as a small child, I had a pretty intense fear of alien abduction. And I remember a lot of nights calling my dad into my room crying because I was terrified to be abducted. And all he could tell me was, you know, reassure me that it wouldn't happen and he would know and he could save me. And you know, as an adult, I recognize those things are not true, really. And even as a child, I knew that. But I did feel comforted by him in those moments enough to, you know, eventually get to sleep. But I had to confront my fear about the phenomenon. And something that actually really helped me do that was the story of Travis Walton. He is a famous abductee. He's the subject of the early 90s movie Fire in the Sky, which also led to a lot of fear for me as I saw it as a very young child. And that movie paints, I'll call them aliens, but I do prefer the more encompassing term of non-human intelligence. But for purposes of this discussion, I'll say aliens. It paints aliens in a really bad light. They abducted Walton, subjected him to certain analysis and procedures, and then dumped him off naked in the desert. Travis Walton, in recent years, he's a speaker. He does a lot of talking about this. And he says that after many years of reflection, he feels differently about his abduction now. He doesn't have the level of fear. He doesn't feel that he was merely sort of a tool in their analysis. He got incredibly close to a UFO. His body was damaged by the radiation from that UFO. He feels that the aliens took him to heal him before they returned him to the earth. And so his insight over this really helped me shift my perspective on it. We do fear what we don't know, but it's not necessarily, even if we can't understand it, I don't think that this phenomenon is necessarily something that is out to hurt us. I also don't think that it's anything new. I think that this phenomenon has been around for a very long time. And acknowledging the truth of it is just acknowledging what is already. And I am somebody who wants to confront truth and reality and who is highly self-reflective. And these are things that I want to know. I recognize not everybody is like that, but I think that confronting fear and some healthy self-reflection are both good things for personal self-growth.
I think even just from so many perspectives, those who are like have that fear of UFO and, you know, or non-human intelligence, as you said, there's that kind of fear. And then there's the fear of almost their mind being changed,
yep.
Being confronted with information that challenges what you've thought before. I think the main thing from that I got from you was to acknowledge your fear, face it, and kind of go into it with an open mind and ready to understand a little bit better the thing that maybe you are afraid of.
Very well said.
Thank you.
Tar City Productions is proud to present, in conjunction with Daniel Zalehouse, the first annual Tar City Freak Show!
Dialogue's Cora Perrigo went to Tar City's Freak Show earlier this month. She watched the premiere of two different horror shows, Posey and Carl.
Posey was about a young man returning home, seemingly facing both real childhood familial trauma, as well as something more supernatural. Carl featured a religious zealot and misogynist, pseudo-Dr. Frankenstein, and his grotesque creation. Both were compelling, disturbing, and a little gross.
I spoke to Eve Croft, a member of the Tar City crew who works on the special effects and various other arts and crafts involved in their filmmaking. Eve was inspired to begin her journey into SFX through her love of all things horror and got involved in Tar City through her mother, Sandy Pearl, who had previous connections with Fritz Bishop. Eve helped to design the character and prosthesis for Posey and created the Carl prop, which was a new medium for her. Her biggest inspirations in the field are Damien Leone, who is behind the Terrifier movies, and Mikey, the creator behind the YouTube channel Glam and Gore. She has also started out on a small business journey with her brand Shroud of Eve, which you can find on Facebook. Now, here is a continuation of my interview with the head of Tar City Productions, Fritz Bishop.
None of us are professional, and everybody who got involved with Tar City just messaged and asked if they could. And we've had people start out as, like Zachary, who's premiering his second short film. He started out, he was coming to do audio, and then he arrived on the day, and he's from Shetty Camp, which is kind of close. Like, I grew up in Pleasant Bay, which is a bit of a mountain away, but in relative terms to rural Cape Breton or neighboring towns. Anyways, he grew up in Shetty Camp, and he got involved with us. And he was supposed to do audio, and then he came up, and I said, don't you do camera work? And then I said, do you make your own shorts? He said, yeah, make one. I said, we're gonna distribute it or produce it as best we can. We want to get it out there. And now he's directing his own thing. He's writing. They're all very talented. I'm very lucky. And everyone who started, they just had to reach out. That's it. And, you know, we train people on every piece of equipment. All that I ask is that you're willing to put the work in and try and be told that it's wrong. It's okay. It's okay to be told that it's wrong. I wish I had somebody telling me that what I was doing was wrong, because I didn't know. I didn't know until it was up on a screen in front of all these people. And I was like, oh my God, man, I didn't edit that very well. Like, what was I thinking?
Someone telling you you're wrong. I think to critique something is because you love it and you want it to be better.
It's
not.
Yeah,
it's not because, like, oh, I hate it. Because if you hated it, you'd be like, yeah, it's fine, whatever. You wouldn't think about it.
That's exactly true. Yeah, that's exactly true. And it's tough for... Look, we could all go out, have a good time, not really put that much effort in, and probably the product's not going to be that good at the end. But I want things to be as good as they can, so I am hard on the crew sometimes. I say, sometimes your best isn't good enough. It needs to be better. You need to work at it every single day. I'm in the mires of editing right now, and I will watch back something I'm working on, I don't know, probably close to 2,543 times before I'm willing to say, okay, yeah, you know, I did my best, and that's what I got to work with, and I'm happy with it, and I'm willing to grind for a while and say this isn't good enough, and telling yourself it's not good enough is tough. You have to be your own critic, and you have to take criticism as well. Like, people are very giving and very kind. I find, like, I don't get as much criticism as I probably deserve, or as much as I would like, because I want it to be better. But sometimes it kind of gets lost in the, oh, it's just cool that you're doing something. So people aren't willing to be like, yeah, man, like, what was with that edit, like that cut from there to there? So
yeah.
I make up for what I don't receive, because I'm my own worst self-critic. And when I show something to somebody and then they tell me they don't like it or they have their opinion on it, then you have to actually take that in and listen to it and consider it and say to yourself, like, you know, could it be better? And what's the middle ground between, like, your vision and what you want to do versus what's going to appeal to your audiences and what people are generally going to be impressed by, right? It's a tough middle ground. The best thing you can do is just be humble, take the criticisms, and use them to your benefit. That's all great information. It's interesting. I don't think people really understand just how rich the artistic community is in Sydney. And maybe that's because sometimes we don't do enough to support each other and help each other out. So maybe that'll change over time.
I've thought for a long time that the fear of collaboration was this perfectionism, this wanting control over your own idea. And I do think to some extent that is. But Jeff Wilson, he runs the Sketchbook Socials. I believe he's an art teacher. He said something at a workshop that really put it, like, zoomed in on it. And it was, no, it's because the person who's afraid of collaboration is afraid that the idea they have is the best idea they'll ever have.
And hopefully, if you're a good enough artist, you should be able to create that sort of collaborative environment where you can all learn from each other. We don't really, we all have, like, duties on a set, but if somebody speaks up because they have a good idea, then let's try it. Like, that happens all the time. We've been doing something and we're like, oh, we can't get the shot to work. And then somebody who's literally just there to run food or, you know, whatever, is just like, hey, well, why don't you try this? And it's like, oh, dang, yeah, that actually works really well. So you have to be open to that collaboration, and you have to be willing to try things and give people a shot, because everybody just wants to make the best thing possible. Nobody wants to make a bad thing, which you see some things that get made these days and you're like, man, how? But there is actually hundreds of very passionate people behind every terrible movie and every awful book. And, you know, there was a lot of passion behind that, and it was misplaced and things didn't work out and that sort of thing. But everybody wants to make the best thing possible. So when you give them that opportunity, and when you're in an open, communicative, collaborative environment, people will blow you away, man. I'm shocked every time that we pull it off, quite frankly. Every production, I'm just like in shock. I'm like, I can't believe we just pulled that off again. And that's every music video. That's every short. That's every ad. That's everything that we do. I'm always like, wow, that was amazing. That was a bunch of strangers coming together, feeling really awkward in a room together for a little while, and then kind of, you know, getting to know each other and everybody speaking up. And wow, we did it. And it's this amazing thing we can all be proud of. We can all enjoy it and share it together. I'm kind of pulling back into more of producer sort of area, where I'm more into the planning of things. I'm not going to be writing as much. I'm not going to be directing as much. I'm not going to be acting at all if I can help it. But that's kind of where my skills and my interests have led me. I like putting it together. I like doing everything on the day. And then on the day of like set, if you go to one of our sets, I'm sitting somewhere and just smoking off the sidelines and kind of watching it happen. I just want to put those people in the room, give them the tools, give them the know-how, be there for advice and for, you know, to help. But most of my sets, man, I just sit around. And then the work for me is the month before, and the work for me is the month after. You know, I'm really into the pre-production, I'm really into the editing. But giving other people the opportunity to actually direct things, it's cool. It's awesome to watch. It's impressive. You should be constantly challenging yourself to different medias. You should be always trying out different things. And like for me personally, like once I felt like I had accomplished what I wanted to with directing, it was like, why would I just sit here and hog this spot for the rest of my life? Why don't I look at something else, see where I could be more useful? And that's how you should be as an artist in whatever you're doing. So if you were the guitarist for a band, let's say, then when you move on, maybe you should look into what it means to start the band. Maybe you should look into what it means to book events and book shows and challenge yourself, man. If you're comfortable in what you're doing, you're wasting your own time. But you should be always challenging yourself to do something different. The other thing I would tell people is they should just surround themselves with more artists that do the things that interest them. And you're going to be inspired by those people. Really quickly, I just wanted to give some recognition to the two directors. Christian Coombs, a good friend of mine, he's directing Posey, which is the short film about the Skinwalker that I wrote. And Michael McNeil, who's been my left hand now for many, many moons, he directed the short written by Zachary, which is called Carl. And we had the very, very talented cinematographer, Matthew Ingram. And he did the camera work for us on Posey. So just a lot of really talented folks, and all from very unique disciplines, backgrounds. One of my most trusted audio people is a rapper. You know, Jake McKenzie's fantastic. Jay Cobra, I've directed his music videos before too. So it's you surround yourself with a good artist, you're kind of inevitably going to make good art, especially if you're all patient and willing to help each other out. And screw up, look stupid, start over, scrap it, do it again. Like, you're going to have more failure than success, so take them all as they come.
Scotiabank customers in Waterford and Glace Bay have to make other plans. They are greeted at their main entrances with signs reading closing on November 19th. The bank is consolidating across many regions in Canada, including Nova Scotia. The customers were told all of their banking information is being switched to Scotiabank on Charlotte Street in Sydney. Other options include using online banking or signing up at another branch. Coast Radio spoke to some frustrated clients.
Kind of nervous of banking online. I don't like to tap or anything like that. I'm not any good at the computers or anything.
With everybody that's around in the population, I don't understand why the two banks are closing. You know, I have to travel to Sydney, and it's usually busy. You have to wait in the lineup.
I feel like I'm going to close mine and go to a different bank because I'm very upset. I don't really understand the reasoning behind it. I personally don't do online banking. I prefer my banking either at the ATM or with a teller.
That's terrible. I have to go to Sydney to get a check. And, you know, I guess I'll have to.
I could see if in an area it's too small, they don't have enough business, but leave at least the option of one bank between Sydney, Glace Bay, and New Waterford. Don't close us out altogether. I'm disappointed in that.
Oh, well, I have to go to Sydney. It's an inconvenience, but it's going to be blocked. It's going to be busy.
Marcy Shorey Stanley is an advocate for people with disabilities and seniors. She says many will be troubled because they don't use computers, not to mention some will have major problems in transportation.
For instance, I have a friend in New Waterford. Now, I'm not sure how, I haven't talked to him lately, but I know that a lot of the times, not in the winter, but he will go on his power chair down to the bank. It's in New Waterford, actually. And it's very difficult. And if you're talking about online banking, a lot of people with disabilities, and when we're talking about people with disabilities, we're also including seniors. Because a lot of seniors, not all, but a lot of them, have a disability. So seniors, a lot of them don't have a computer. A lot of them don't know how to use a computer, and that's another a pet peeve of mine, because I've been on a lot of boards and commissions and whatever, and I'll tell you, everything is, go to www such and such, and I sound like a drum when I'm at these meetings, and I say, that's not being inclusive to people with disabilities and also seniors.
The Scotiabank branch closed in Sydney Mines about 2 years ago. The bank refused an interview with Coast Radio News, but they issued a statement. It says, after careful consideration, we announced in 2023 that we made the difficult decision to close the Glace Bay and New Waterford branches in November 2024 and relocate our in-person services to the Sydney branch at 258 Charlotte Street, Sydney, Nova Scotia. With customer preferences changing and more day-to-day banking being done digitally, we are continuing to evolve how we serve our customers and invest in areas that make it easier for our customers to bank with us from wherever they are. And the statement ends with, we are committed to supporting our customers, employees, and communities through this transition. That's all for Dialogue this week. If you have an idea for the show, please send us an email at news@coastalradio.ca. Thanks for listening. I'm Bill McCush.